they are really, I believe, a springboard to something a lot more profound, transformative. So, as with any spiritual path, the jumping off point, if you like, is faith. But this is not faith in a particular dogma or dogmas that you have to hold on very tightly to and to protect yourself from possibility of doubt. In fact, maybe this is a subject that I'll get into a bit later on, that doubt is welcomed rather than feared in Buddhist tradition, at least certain kinds of doubt. But the kind of faith that is needed here is faith in your ability to do something about your life. Indeed, the conventional explanation of what faith means in Buddhism is in faith in the Buddha's enlightenment, which means faith in the enlightenment of a very special human being. But in this school of Buddhism, particularly, the humanity of the Buddha is emphasized. And so his enlightenment was a proof to the human race of the potential that we have for transformation. And the Buddha abandoned all suffering and the causes of suffering irrevocably. And by doing so, he proved that is something that human beings can do. And if you can accept that as a basic proposition, then the next step from that is that if it's something that human beings can do, then it's something that you can do. So, can you accept that as a proposition? You know, you can abandon the negative, you can abandon, you can develop, perfect positive qualities, you can purify your mind. If you have the confidence or that seems reasonable to you that you can do that, then the next step is, or should you do it, what are the advantages and disadvantages of doing so? I think for myself, I'm hard pushed to think of any disadvantages. I can think of a lot of advantages. And suggest that through this effort to purify our lives, our conduct, our emotions, our minds and hearts, that we become fully human, we fully realize the potential of this human state, and that I would argue that many of us live in, like living in a huge mansion and just living in one or two small rooms. And although we may feel that in the sensual realm of forms and sounds and odors and tastes and physical sensations, that one has quite a lot of freedom, from another perspective, that is a very limited and impoverished kind of freedom, just the freedom of seeing a variety of forms and hearing nice sounds and nice smells and eating good foods and so on. It's ultimately doesn't go anywhere. It just goes round and round and round. But there is a transcendence which does not necessarily entail or demand the renunciation of all the simple physical pleasures of life. But it is one in which they lose their obsessive and demanding role in our consciousness. So the Buddhism is sometimes presented as a very kind of pessimistic philosophy and faith, and everyone knows that Buddhists teach about suffering. But I was at a large gathering of Buddhist people in Aurangabad yesterday, and I was saying, isn't it noticeable that whatever you may read about Buddhism, particularly by non-Buddhists, when Buddhists get together, you never see so many smiling faces and so much kindness and laughter. And I don't think that that's a paradox or a contradiction, quite the opposite. So the Buddha said that in the vast number of his teachings, he teaches basically two things, suffering and the end of suffering. So that's why this is an inaccurate representation. It misses out the second most important part, is the end of suffering. And the basic idea behind that, I don't think is a controversial one, and that is that if you want to effect any positive change, whether it's in your life or in your family or your business or whatever, you have to clearly identify what the problems are. And you go to a doctor, the diagnosis precedes the treatment. You have to be very clear about exactly what's going on and what needs to be dealt with. So this is the approach taken by the Lord Buddha, and the Buddhist path is to clearly determine what is the problem, what are the causes and conditions underlying the problem. And in our daily life, I think that this, as I say, is completely normal, to the extent that we wouldn't even think twice if whatever religious tradition you belong to, or whether you belong to no religious tradition at all, if your car was to break down on the on a highway, I don't think there's anybody who would just say, well, that's my karma, it was meant to happen, something I did in a past life. I don't think anybody would sit and pray for their god or gods to help them. I think if anyone had a mobile phone, they'd get in touch with a garage, and if they don't know how to deal with the problem themselves, then they'd find somebody who can help them to do so. So it's simply that in Buddhist tradition, we apply that kind of common sense approach to the quality of our lives. That if there's some imbalance, that there's suffering, mental suffering in life, it means that there's something wrong and something that needs to be treated, remedied. So the Buddha is called the great physician, the great doctor. He's the person who diagnoses the condition, prescribes the medicine, and the Dhamma, his teachings, are not, as I say, dogmas to be believed in and to be attached to, but they are the medicine to be applied. And the Sangha, the enlightened teachers through the ages, are those who have applied the medicines, that they are skilled in the use of medicine, people who have taken the medicine and then recovered from their illness, at least to one extent, and so are witnesses to and skilled teachers of the correct way to take the medicine. So as far as the confidence to take on a spiritual discipline goes, then it is important to review your life and to be quite honest and about the suffering that you've experienced in life, and the often will see recurrent patterns in the suffering that's arisen in our lives. I mean, when I was a younger monk, I did a very long solitary retreat in a cave in Western Thailand. And it's a common experience for meditators that when you're living that kind of almost sensory deprivation for a very long time, that a lot of memories from childhood and so on will pop up into your mind. And often there'll be particular songs and even advertising jingles and things. You think, where does that come from? But some of the stuff that arises in your mind is does have a definite relationship to the experiences, although you're not consciously bringing that up. But I remember on this retreat the word and the song that would come up is an old David Bowie. I don't know if anybody knows David Bowie. Song called "Always Crashing in the Same Car," and this was his his example or way of talking about that, something that I think most of us recognize in our lives when we make a mistake, do something stupid, and we say, never again, I'm never going to do that again, I'm never going to be so stupid, it's just not worth it, it's just too painful. And then before very long we find we do exactly the same thing again. Or how many of us have said as children, you know, when I'm a parent, I'm not going to be like my mum or dad, I'm not going to do that, and I'm not going to be like that. And then, you know, 30, 40 years later, you turn around and you realize you're behaving just like your mum or dad did. And so there are all these kinds of things going on within us, which are engines of suffering. And a lot of the structures underlying the way that we relate to ourselves, our own experience, the way we relate to other people, is invisible to us, but doesn't necessarily have to remain so. For those of you who are maybe skeptical about that or not so sure, one of my favorite examples is from World of Psychology. It's a very well-known professor in Southern California called Professor Charles Tart. And he's done a number of very fascinating experiments with hypnosis. And in one of them, or a whole set of them, he hypnotizes volunteers, students of his. And while they're in the hypnotic state, he says to them, after you come out of this hypnotic state, I will invite you for a cup of tea. And when I invite you for a cup of tea, I want you to walk over to the door and put up the umbrella that's standing behind the door. So the student is brought out of the hypnotic state, and the professor says, thank you very much, that's very good. Would you like a cup of tea? Immediately, the student walks over to the door, puts up the umbrella, and the professor says to him, why did you do that? And he said, well, I noticed on the way in that it was very cloudy and I didn't bring an umbrella with me, and I was wondering whether I might use that one. It looks a bit old and I thought it might have a leak in it, and I was just wondering. And so the point of it being that immediately this young man or whoever was the subject of the experiment, and this was repeated many times, immediately, without a moment's hesitation, could come up with a lot of very convincing reasons why he did something completely irrational. I mean, there's absolutely no reason why he should go and put up that umbrella other than that he was told to do so while he was in a hypnotic state. And I think this is quite, I always find this quite stunning and humbling to recognize to what extent this quite incredible creative power of rationalization runs our lives. And it's not, you know, I think most of us have come across this idea of rationalizing, make up excuses to justify things that you've done. But generally I think that we consider it to be something you sort of sit and think about it, and it's a little bit dishonest. But in fact, it's just part and parcel of the way that the normal mind works. So there are all kinds of things going on within us that we are not often conscious of. And how many times has somebody made a comment about us, about our personality, and you think, no, I'm not like that, you know. And then other people say, well, you are. And you think, really, you know. And or you have most of us have quite fixed ideas about what kind of person we are. And so that tends to blind us to all the ways that we are not like that. It seems to me increasingly common, at least for people who do really stupid things that they're caught by the police for, like celebrities or whoever, and then they make a statement like, this is not who I really am, this is not the real me that did this, you know, therefore, you know, I'm not really culpable. Or people who drink alcohol and then act in very unskillful ways will say, you know, it's not really me, it was the alcohol. So that there's this idea that you don't have to take responsibility for certain things that don't suit your idea of who you are. So in meditation practice, in spiritual life, is we're putting aside, you know, all our preconceived ideas about who we are and what we are, and trying to develop a skill of looking directly at the nature of things. So not starting off with a theory or a philosophy and trying to fit our experience to it, but we're trying to develop the tools and the skills to be able to dwell with our experience free of concepts. And then certain conclusions and theories may arise as a product of that, but ideally they're not preceding it. So here again I'm referring to some particular Buddhist premises, if you like, or hypotheses and things to take on board, that our suffering in life is due from a lack of clear understanding of what our life really is, who we are, and that the way to true happiness or freedom from suffering is by uncovering, by looking clearly. And the more clearly you see things, the more free and happy you become. So here we're saying that truth and happiness, or the penetration, direct, let's say, non-verbal experience of what in Buddhist idiom is called the way things are, is the path to true peace and happiness. So it's not a matter of, as I say, of taking on any particular belief system, but it demands a readiness and a willingness and a courage to be looking very directly, clearly at your life and, of course, particularly your mind. Now, as I say, that often people take on a meditation practice without integrating it into their life, so it becomes kind of a hobby for a while, perhaps. And very few people who take it on in that way stick with it through thick and thin. It may be, it's like a good weather or a good weather friend, or at least something that people maybe apply when they're feeling very tense and anxious and unhappy, but when things change and they feel a little bit more relaxed and not so depressed, then we'll let it go. So this is something else that we need to consider, not just the knowledge and understanding and information about what meditation is, but also bringing all the emotions, the positive emotions, on board, which are going to sustain that kind of practice for a long term, because this is definitely an endeavor that requires a great deal of time and commitment over a long period. It's not a something that you can crack in a sort of a, certainly not in a 1 day course, but even in a 10 day course or a number of 10 day courses. It's really developing a new approach to your life. Now, the most important foundations and like sort of the support structure for meditation. Two things really. There are more than two things, but simplify here. First is generosity and kindness and giving, sharing, because this is the initial opening of the mind. The mind that is so obsessed in accumulation and getting and being, and that mind is completely hostile to spiritual life. That the sort of selfish accumulating mind might think it's very very smart and clever. It's actually a creating the causes and conditions for a lot of future unhappiness and pain. So undermining, going against that stream of anxiety and attachment, identification with possessions, wealth and possessions, is very first foundation stone for spiritual life. So the extent to which you know you're involved in charitable projects, and the it's going to depend, of course, on your income and family situation and so on and so forth. But at least to have some sense of devoting some part of your income to some good cause, not directly to your own benefit. So whether it's to particularly charities and cancer funds or orphanages or spiritual, really whatever it is that inspires you and uplifts you, and that once you've shared your some wealth and something that you have accumulated with others without any hope of any reward, even of praise or prestige in any way, you feel a lightening and a joy in life. And so, you know, this is, number one, and he sort of, or the very first ingredients of an anti-depression vaccine. I mean, someone who loves to give and loves to share, doesn't tend to get depressed very easily, because it's just such a joyful activity. And it gives you that positive self-regard, self-esteem, of someone, of being someone who shares. The second aspect is of ethics, morality. And in Buddhism, morality is not consist of commandments, but of training rules. And the idea is that we voluntarily, it's very important, you voluntarily take upon yourself certain boundaries for conduct as a means of simplifying your life, as a means of guarding against creation of bad karma through body and speech, as a means of creating trust and harmony in family and communities, and as a way of developing mindfulness of intention. So the Buddha at one point said that sila or morality is intention. The essence of morality is intention. And on another occasion, the essence of karma is intention. So the ability to illuminate, to recognize intention as it arises and passes away in your mind is absolutely essential to any kind of creative ethical practice in life, rather than just a blind kind of adherence to certain rules out of desire for some heavenly reward or a fear of falling into hell after you die, but the recognition of the ways in which these wisely adopted and voluntarily adopted boundaries enrich your lives and enrich the life of your family and community. This is the important point here. As a means of training and of conduct, which, as I say, underlines and leads into the training of the mind. I'll give a very simple example. We all of us have instincts, just like animals, but we do have this ability to be aware of our instincts, to step back from this metacognition. So if you just naturally always swatted mosquitoes when they bite you because you don't like it when they bite you, that it hurts, it itches, and maybe there's malaria around or something. So the intention to kill is so swiftly translated into the action of killing. It's so quick that you're not even aware of the arising of intention in your mind, which is the arising of kamma in your mind on the mental level. Now, if you've taken on the precept, say, to refrain from killing, then the moment that you're about to swat the mosquito, and then this thought pops up into your mind, that's against my precept. Now, that is a moment of awakening. You've awakened to what's going on in your mind at that particular moment, which is the intention to kill. And so you have, as it were, driven a wedge in between the intention to act and the action itself, or the intention to speak, and the speech itself. Now, that is a moment of awakening, and what is very significant here is that you now have choices. The instinctive mind is the conditioned mind, the mechanical mind, robot mind, is just following instructions and just taking the immediate pain and pleasure as its criteria, whether to move towards or move away from something, to act or not to act. This is just the instinctual nature of physical body habit. But with the boundary taken on here, we said we're not going to kill, then we stop, and then questions can arise. Well, do I really want to do this? Is there some way that I can achieve my objective, you know, of not being bitten without actually killing the creature? Could I just blow him away? Could I just apply some other means or other? So, in summary, the conditioned mind has very few choices and alternatives, where the awakened mind has many choices. So in daily life, this is with creativity and taking responsibility for your life becomes real. It's not just a slogan, but it's something that you're developing as a training. So this is not something that is necessarily just going to happen by itself if you meditate every day, but it's something which supports the meditation, and if you meditate every day, it becomes more easy to do. So the daily life should be sort of feeding into the meditation, and meditation feeding into daily life. So with generosity, sharing, kindness, practical application of goodwill and non-attachment, and with the keeping of precepts, there is this lack of guilt and self-aversion and what's this self-respect, self-esteem, and these are, in the long run, are absolutely essential to success in the training of the mind and heart. Now, in the in the Western world, guilt, self-aversion, is just a major impediment, major obstacle to spiritual life. For instance, in the traditional teachings of spreading thoughts of loving kindness and compassion, we are advised to begin with the one that we love the most, and that's ourselves, and to develop that sense of loving kindness towards yourself, and then from there you spread it to the loved one, and from the loved one to the neutral person, from the neutral person finally, when the mind is very strong and fortified with these feelings of love, towards the enemy or the disliked person. So you start off with what's easiest, and gradually building up the mental power to be able to spread to the most difficult. But the experience of many of my friends and colleagues in Western countries is that people get stuck. They just can't get going on step one. They just find it impossible to develop feelings of loving kindness for themselves. And so say, well, start off with, you know, a little kitten or a puppy, you know, or something that you can just say, oh, that's really cute, that's really lovable. And then so develop that thing. So it can actually be a long time before people can spread loving kindness to themselves. Now, you know, there are a number of reasons, cultural, religious reasons why this sense of self-aversion and guilt is so prevalent. One of them, I think, is that somehow we feel, Western people particularly, tend to feel that unwholesome and negative things are more real than good and wholesome things. So if, for instance, and this is not restricted to Western people, but let's say you have intention to do something really kind for somebody or some, let's say make some kind of donation to a charity or do something, and you just feel so joyful about it, and it's just such a wonderful thing to do. And then within the course of that good action, something just pops up in your mind to say that, well, when I do this, so-and-so is going to be really impressed, or people are just going to respect me so much, and it's really good for my image, or something like that. And then the tendency is to grasp onto that particular thought, say, yeah, that's what I'm really doing it for, isn't it? Let's be honest. You know, there's got to somehow the cynical voice always sounds, he's the realist. You know, somehow being cynical is being realistic. You know, this is what's really me, isn't it? All I really want is for people to love and respect me and look up to me. Well, in actual fact, if you look more closely on the course of, I don't know, an hour or 2 hours, you must have all these really positive, beautiful thoughts coming up. But why is it that just one or two negative thoughts somehow seems so much more weighty and, as they say, realistic than all the positive thoughts? So in meditation, this is something that we begin to see where, you know, there's no reason why we should give any more significance to a negative thought than a positive thought. Now, in this system, Buddhism, we're making a distinction, a very important distinction, between action and speech on one side and mental processes on the other. Now, action and speech is something that you can deal with effectively, constructively, with willpower, or with this, as I say, this voluntary intention to say no, to refrain from certain kinds of actions. But the mistake that is often made is to extend that, or to try to apply willpower to mental processes. So, to illustrate that, I think it's very wise, skillful to say that anger is a negative mental state. It's not something that I want to cultivate or something I want to carry around with me the rest of my life. I believe that I have the ability within me, the potential within me, to transcend anger. And I want to. I want to follow this path. Okay, so far so good. But now you say, I am not going to be angry with anybody today. And I said, sit in front of your shrine, or you know, sit and meditate, or whatever. I said, I'm not going to get angry with anybody today. And of course, you can't do that. It's impossible, because the causes and conditions which support the arising of anger within the mind are not susceptible to willpower. It's a basic and quite naive psychological mistake that people make. What you can do is you can say, no matter how angry I get with that person at work, or however angry I get with this and that, I am not going to express it physically or verbally. Now that is not, please observe, repression. Repression is when you don't acknowledge that you're angry. You know, sometimes people are sort of red in the face. I'm not angry. I'm not angry. You know, it's just so like this. You know, so angry that you should think that they're angry. So this is not repression. This is recognition. There is anger, and experiencing it fully, and just being patient with it as a negative mental state. But one is not adding to it, feeding it through action or speech. Now, if you consistently refuse to act upon a particular intention, after a while that intention becomes much weaker. It becomes atrophied, as it were. It doesn't disappear, but it is much reduced in intensity. So if you don't make this distinction, you don't understand how the mind works, and you start saying, I'm a religious person, you know, I have a lot of faith in my religion, I should be kind, I should be good, I should be unselfish, because my spiritual tradition tells me that I should be that way. You know, I shouldn't get angry, I should forgive other people, I should love others like I love myself. But then there's this voice and you say, but I don't, I can't, you know, I'm not. In many ways I'm jealous, I'm selfish at times, I get angry. And so the mistake here is thinking, I'm such a bad person, I'm hopeless, I'm terrible. All the things that the great spiritual teachers tell me to do, all the ways they say I should be, I'm not like that, I can't be like that, I can't do it. And this is where this is a really kind of negative inversion. I'm hopeless, I'm terrible. So what I'm suggesting here is, one, to recognize that merely having some sense of inspiration or ideal or faith that you shouldn't be a certain way, you should be, is not enough to make any real difference in your life. Willpower is appropriate and can be used for external expression. But when you don't act upon these mental states, then you can start to see mental states as mental states. This is important. Okay. And then you begin to realize that you're not a good person because you have good thoughts, and you're not a bad person because you have bad thoughts, and you're not a confused person because you have confused thoughts. But you have to now, looking in terms of experience rather than ideas about yourself, you say, yes, there are good thoughts arising and passing away. But bad thoughts arise and pass away in the stream of consciousness. OK? confused thoughts arise and pass away. And these good thoughts, bad thoughts, confused thoughts, although they're not divinely inspired, they're not just a matter of blind chance, it's not just the product of chemicals in your brain or some sort of mechanical imperative from your genes, but it's something which is conditioned and something which can respond to present conduct, behavior, attitude, and practice. These are the kinds of concepts you're having to take upon yourselves. Now this practice of, as I say, looking directly, can we do it? You say, well, maybe difficult, but then what makes it difficult? Why is it that we lack that kind of self-awareness, that inner harmony between what's going on inside, outside? And the first thing we really lack is mindfulness. Mindfulness and inner peace and clarity. Now, many of you have probably meditated before, tried to meditate. I'm sure almost all of you will say it's tough, it's difficult. And the reason is that we are very habituated to having something go on in our minds all the time. And you can see this probably most clearly in times of, say, grief. If someone is bereaved, then a person will try to have something to do, something to think about, something to be absorbed into, so that he doesn't have to, she doesn't have to be with their grief. Or another example or illustration of this is to observe people on airplanes, most people, or long trips, that people need some kind of amusement, interest. So on a plane, what do you have? You can have your book, you've got a movie, you've got something to eat, maybe you can watch the map and see how far the plane's got, things like that. But once, you know, you've read a bit of your book, you've watched the movie, you've had something to eat, and then, you know, there's nothing to do, nothing really to think about, and maybe you don't have anyone to talk to, most people go to sleep. So the general habit we have is, you know, that we need to have something going on. And if there's not something going on, then we go to sleep. So sort of no activity and absence, or activity and dullness. And this is one of the great challenges of meditation, that to begin with your mind can be very confused and agitated and running on, and then you finally feel you're getting a handle on it, and suddenly you go into this really dull state, you get very sleepy, and you can get very discouraged by that. So something to recognize, to be aware of, and something you have to treat as a challenge. A particular difficulty for those of you who are, most of you I think, well educated in the conventional sense, or who make a living using your brain and your intelligence, then the downside of that is that you will tend to identify with thought a great deal, and your sense of yourself, your sense of your own dignity, individuality, uniqueness as a person will be bound up quite a lot with thinking. So in meditation, where thinking doesn't play the prime role, and quite the opposite. We're trying to develop a clarity of awareness independent of thought. Then fear can come up quite a lot. So this is a particular obstacle. But it's teaching, you know, if you find that the mind just shuts down after a certain level, or there's a sort of fear that one's losing control, then you know, this is a clear indication of a strong identification with and attachment to the presence of thought. You're taking thought and the presence of thought, the activity of thought, as a refuge. And that's not a trustworthy refuge to take in your life. So apart from the necessity to develop good thinking skills in your life, then we also need to develop the ability to dwell clear with clarity, brightness, precision, without thinking. This is the balance that we need, and all of us tend to lack. There are certain things that you can discover and you can accomplish an awful lot with logic, imagination, good thinking skills. But there are an awful lot of things and whole dimensions to life, very profound experiences that can only be penetrated when you're willing to let go of thinking. Not to, you know, let go of thinking forever and just become like a rock or an insentient object, but not being a slave of thought and being obsessed with thought, or being unable to dwell without thought even for a few seconds. So in meditation, this is one of the skills that we want to develop, basically, to find this middle way between thought and dullness, or thought and absence, one in which you can be completely alive and sharp and bright and joyful, but without any need and compulsion to be thinking about the experience. And through developing a capacity to dwell in that non-verbal, but very bright and awake state, then insights about life, about yourself, will start to bubble up into consciousness. Now this, in fact, is a principle that is recognized in both in the artistic and scientific fields. If you have a chance to read the biographies of great scientists, then you have this sort of Eureka principle, you know, with, of course, named after Archimedes, who's working very hard on this problem for a long time, and then relaxes, has a bath, and then he sits in the bath, says, Eureka, and runs through the streets naked and shouting. And it's remarkable how often this same kind of principle has been repeated throughout the intellectual history of mankind. So many of the most important discoveries, the really new perspectives, have taken place after an initial gathering of information, analysis of information, creation of hypotheses and inferences and so on, and then just putting it all down for a certain length of time and just dwelling in peace and allowing it all in the subconsciously to sort of meld and to be digested. And then sometimes someone's getting on a bus, getting off a bus, sitting in the bath, having their lunch, and suddenly there it is, you know, sort of the theorem, the new discovery. So this is somewhat similar, but on a much lower level to the kinds of insights that come up in meditation, where you're putting your mind in that very fertile, fallow state, and when open, relaxed, a sense of ease, happiness, safety, and clarity, which allows this insight to bubble up and to appear in your consciousness. So the initial work is to train our minds to let go of the past and the future on those occasions where we don't need to think about the past and the future. So we're not saying, you know, forget the past and don't think of the future, just dwell in the present moment all the time. You know, this is sometimes called New Age kind of thing, be in the present moment. But it's a lot more than that, and of course in your life you're having to draw upon past experiences to deal constructively with present challenges. You need a certain amount of planning for future. But in the meditation period, you're very clear with yourself that, okay, this is the time when I'm going to apply myself to meditation, to developing the skill of being in the present moment, and I'm not going to think about the past, not going to think about the future, I'm going to think about my job or difficulties at home, conflicts and various kind of worries, that I'm just going to put it all down. Like you're traveling along, you're walking with two heavy suitcases, you know, past and future, and saying, just put those down for the moment, just rest my arms and just stand and just be here. And you know, that doesn't mean you're abandoning your suitcases forever, but it means right now you don't need them and you don't want them. So in meditation, you have to be very clear right at the beginning of the meditation exactly what you're doing, what your goal is, what your purpose is, what you do want to do, what you don't want to do. Because if you have to be considering those kinds of questions during the meditation, then your mind was not going to become calm and peaceful. It will interrupt the flow of the meditation. So you want to be putting these instructions, placing these instructions right in the forefront of your mind at the beginning of the meditation. And then in the course of the mind, if that doubt just arises, then immediately the thought that you've implanted at the beginning of the meditation will pop up as an answer, and you will not be distracted from the meditation. So there are many, many different meditation techniques, and there's no right ones and wrong ones, and meditators are encouraged to try different things out and try to find a meditation object which you enjoy. So in texts you'll find reference to concept of finding the meditation technique which is suited to your particular personality, and that can, you know, cause a lot of sort of doubts and confusion. I think that the best interpretation of that is finding a meditation topic which you feel some enthusiasm for, that you feel some interest in, that you basically enjoy doing, because that is really the essential point. More important than anything else is you enjoy meditating, because if you don't, you won't keep it up, basically. If you don't have some pleasure and joy, enjoyment, it will be hard responsibilities to fulfill so many pressures upon you in your daily life, that it really has to be something that you treasure and cherish and enjoy greatly, to the extent that you know you can't bear to to miss it, meditation every day. So by adopting a particular time of day to meditate, and by doing it in the same place every time, you try to create like a routine, to the extent that you would have the same feelings about missing out on that part of your day, the same feelings that you would have about missing your breakfast, let's say. It just becomes an integral part of your daily life. So we, in modern world, I think we do tend to be very obsessed or give a little bit too much importance to technique and information. I think that we can just gather all the information, then we'll be all right. It's just a matter of hard work applying the technique. But that's not really the case, I think. It's so much is bound up with your attitudes towards the technique. So to use this kind of IQ, EQ kind of paradigm, then we give too much importance to the IQ side. What exactly do you do? What's the technique? Are there some special tricks and shortcuts? And, what's it all about? And then you think, well, you've gathered all the possible information from all these different teachers and you've got it all down. It's just a matter of just getting stuck in. But this is to overlook the whole emotional context of applying a technique. You may know what the technique is, but you'd just be too lazy, you can't be bothered, or too discouraged or depressed or whatever to apply the information that you have acquired. So you must give equal attention both to the particular methods and techniques, but also your general feeling about them and how you feel about it, and how to maintain and promote those emotional states and attitudes and so on, which will sustain your commitment to applying the techniques day in, day out, throughout your life. Okay, so I think that's probably sufficient for an introductory talk, and if those of you, particularly those of you sitting on the floor, probably appreciate just a short break for 5 minutes, would you, just to stretch your legs, and then we'll come back and have a session of sitting meditation.